This week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
This has been a long struggle of bringing world attention to the conditions, the complete shutdown in Gaza. But now, of course, it's more extreme than at any time in the past because everything has just been turned to rubble. There's all-out attacks on the hospitals and so on.
Longtime peace and justice activist Sarah Flounders discusses her trip to Egypt to push for opening the Rafah crossing into Gaza.
The APEC countries, they hide what they want to do. It's a danger for all of us, and we have to stand up to protest it, to bring attention to it.
Peace activists protest the escalating U.S. militarization of Asia during the Asia-Pacific Economic Corporation Summit in San Francisco.
So I've just been removed from an Amtrak train going to Washington, D.C., after I questioned Democratic Senator Chris Coons about his support for the Israeli mass murder campaign in Gaza and his refusal to call for a ceasefire.
Gray Zone journalist Aaron Mate confronts Delaware Senator Chris Coons about U.S. support for Israel's war on Gaza.
You're faced with a bombardment of information about Haiti this, Haiti that, poorest country of the Western Hemisphere, gangs this, gang. And it's my moral obligation to explain what is going on and that there is another way.
And we hear from former First Lady of Haiti, Mrs. Mildred Aristide. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Akua Holt. Longtime peace and justice activist Sarah Flounders speaks to Pacifica's Anne Garrison about her trip to Egypt to push for opening of the Rafah crossing into Gaza.
Longtime peace and justice activist Sarah Flounders, a member of the United National Anti-War Coalition, the Sanctions Kill Coalition, the International Action Center, and the Workers World Party, recently traveled to Egypt with a delegation to push for opening the Rafah crossing to let aid into Gaza. She was joined by members of a long list of organizations, including the Palestine Prisoner Solidarity Network, Black Alliance for Peace, International Association of Democratic Lawyers, U.S. Peace Council, Veterans for Peace, Samadoun, Palestine Rights, Free Julian Assange Committee, Philly Palestine Coalition, and Association for Investment and Popular Action Committees. They were accompanied by representatives of media outlets including Black Agenda Report, RT, The Gray Zone, Real News Network, and Brazil's Diário do Centro do Mundo. We discussed what they saw.
Even in normal circumstances, 500 trucks a day carry supplies into Gaza. They've been under U.S. sanctions for 16 years, ever since the election of the Hamas government, U.S. sanctions and Israeli sanctions. But even during those times, basic food and medicine and essential supplies, 500 trucks a day. Since the Israeli offensive began, that's down to about 10 trucks on some days, maybe a few more on others. In other words, a fraction, a tiny fraction of just the essential needs of the population. Now, so, I think we're on day 46, so you can picture, just do the math of what is being prevented to the whole population.
So a few trucks are being allowed in, like maybe 5 or 10 a day.
Yes, so they say, yeah.
And normally there would be how many?
500 trucks a day.
And so now many more than 500 are needed.
Right. And so from what I understand and from the news, which is covered pretty regularly in Egypt and throughout the Arab world, the story is the lines and lines of these trucks that await passage into Rafah, the miles of trucks.
Okay. So a lot of people are reading about these conditions. They know that it's desperate to get the trucks in. They may not have an image of trucks and trucks and trucks, a long line of trucks waiting to get in. What are the accommodations for these people? I mean, if you're outside Rafah crossing, wind up in a truck, and you're there for days, what do you do?
Well, I don't really know, because the nearest town or city is Al Arish, which is formerly, in years past, was a resort town. It's not functioning that way now. So that is a place where people would stop in times past who were sometimes waiting days to cross into Rafah. But I don't know. I don't know all the arrangements there, and that was part of the purpose of our trip, of our delegation, and our hope to get to Rafah, to show this, to highlight this. Now, this has been covered, as I say, in the Egyptian media and in other media in the Arab world. It is completely censored from U.S. corporate media here, and therefore difficult to cover even for alternative media.
When you say that they've gone to a city, there's only one city in the Sinai. I looked at the map. There's only one city up on the Mediterranean Sea, which would make sense as to why it would be a resort. But otherwise, there's nothing in the Sinai, barely any roads.
Yeah, there's very little. It's really been for a long time a military zone. You can't cross the Suez Canal without military clearance. And then I think it's another 6 hours to Rafah, and Al Arish is about an hour from Rafah.
That's the seaside town.
Mm-hmm.
So we're reading about a lot of these conditions, how bad it is in Gaza, how desperately the people need the trucks to get in. Could you just give us sort of a travelogue so people can imagine what you went through? You arrive in Cairo, city of 10 million people, the capital of Egypt. Where do you go and what do you do?
Well, first of all, the delegation came together and we drafted statements, put out reports. Just for example, Margaret Kimberly made a very important report on Black Agenda report. Others folks were filing reports. We were trying to get clearance and meeting with groups in Egypt, which is very difficult. Egypt is today a military dictatorship. It's not really legal for groups to operate. So the conditions are difficult. The conditions are especially difficult because of the U.S. role in Egypt and in complete collaboration with the Zionists. So you're talking about, on every way, a difficult circumstance. We did several things, such as we went to the Red Crescent. There was a donation made that Susan Abu Hawa, the prominent Palestinian author, made through Playgrounds for Palestine to Red Crescent to try to help the supplies get in. You know, so, we were kind of busy the whole time looking for ways to connect both with the groups who are able to operate in Egypt today, journalists associations and medical associations that are completely focused on this.
So when you said groups aren't allowed to operate, or I guess it's very difficult for them, you're talking about NGOs, relief organizations.
That's right. That's right.
Kind of international delegation like your own.
Mm-hmm.
So did you go to some offices and ask, can we get in?
Yes. And we also had a letter of protest on the U.S. role, a statement to the U.S. embassy. We did notify them we were coming. We asked for an appointment. And when we arrived, instead, the U.S. embassy security met us. We were told first to go across the street and down the street and so on. We complied and then found ourselves all being detained. So this is the way the U.S. operates in Egypt today. Any attention on their role, which is heavy and intense, is met with arrests and so on.
So you were only detained for a couple of hours, right?
That's right, for several hours, yeah.
That was by Egyptian police?
It appeared at the direction of U.S. embassy staff.
At the direction of U.S. embassy staff, but you were detained by Egyptian police?
Yeah.
Were there any other foreign delegations there that you met with?
No, there is an international delegation of conscience that was arriving on the day we were leaving, and their connection also with the Egyptian movement was part of this. But the group that was leaving for Rafah did initially include us in their delegation, and then were told just before departure that no one with a foreign passport would be allowed to participate.
Okay.
So a lot happens at the whim of the Egyptian government.
And it was the Egyptian delegation met with you and said you could join them on their trip to the Rafah crossing. Right?
That's right.
And were they traveling with trucks?
Yes, trucks. And they were in buses. They weren't on the trucks.
But it was one caravan.
Yeah.
Do you have any idea why they told you couldn't go? Just the whim of the Egyptian government?
Well, I think there were people in our delegation who've been involved in many of the boat to Gaza and other efforts to get supplies in past years. I mean, this has been an effort over many years, ever since the U.S. and Israeli sanctions on Gaza, 16 years tightened like a noose. And it's always at the whim of the Egyptian government to even get in to Sinai and across to Rafah. And of course, those who were by boat face the same problem of Israeli attacks. Actually, if you think back to the military attack on the Mavi Marmara, the Turkish humanitarian ship several years ago, this has been a long struggle of bringing world attention to the conditions, the complete shutdown in Gaza. Okay. And that's an important part of this. Anne Wright, who is a former U.S. diplomat who resigned over the war in Iraq, very active now with both the past boats to Gaza struggle and many other issues, was denied entry into Egypt. She was part of our delegation, but she was turned back.
She was denied entry into Egypt. She couldn't even get into Egypt.
That's right.
Okay. And she had been part of a delegation to break the embargo on a boat in the past.
Yes. She's been part of several efforts. And there have been huge efforts that have involved many, many hundreds of people, thousands of people internationally, and past efforts over many years. But now, of course, it's more extreme than at any time in the past because everything has just been turned to rubble. There's all-out attacks on the hospitals and so on, such as Al-Shifa Hospital. And while we were there, of course, the whole time the Egyptian press repeated endlessly in the U.S. corporate media was this claim that the Al-Shifa Hospital was a command center for Hamas and huge bunkers and underground command rooms and all of this wildly distorted. And when they finally destroyed the hospital, they found none of that. And that's important. It's one more Zionist fabrication to try to justify this horrendous war on every level. And it was clear this was a total fiction, that this was the command center of Hamas. So the clearing and the evacuation of Al-Shifa Hospital and many other hospitals, it's not the only one, but Al-Shifa, there was a big focus that this was the command center of Hamas, turned out to be a total lie. There's no tunnels, there's no weapons, there's no command center. They found a Kalashnikov rifle.
Well, in the pictures, they seem to have a handful of rifles and a handful of ammunition. Yes, and the like. Could you talk about the specifics of the sanctions since 2007?
Yes, the sanctions on Gaza are the most extreme form of U.S. sanctions around the world. I mean, there's now U.S. sanctions on 40 countries, a third of the world population. And in every country, it is meant to destabilize, create shortages, create hyperinflation, and are really aimed directly at civilian populations and a complete violation of international law. When Hamas won in democratic elections, an overwhelming majority, and the Israelis and the U.S. were so outraged, they imposed specific sanctions on Gaza in terms of supplies, trade, exchanges, even of the fruit and vegetables and so on that Gaza had produced previously, shutting all that down. So that's been the story for 16 years.
Okay, the Israeli sanctions have U.S. collaboration, U.S. approval. Are there actual sanctions listed with OFAC, the Office of Foreign Assets Control at the Treasury Department?
Yes, as a matter of fact, people have been prosecuted for doing things like gathering money for orphanages in Gaza. Consider the famous case of the Holy Land Five. People facing sentenced to 80 years in U.S. prisons for violating and gathering funds for orphanages in nonprofit organizations that were fully vetted. So it's really the most extreme form of sanctions on an already beleaguered, surrounded people. That's how U.S. sanctions function.
We should probably explain, since sanctions are kind of abstract to a lot of people, sanctions mean a trade embargo. Sanctions are the specifics of a trade embargo, exactly what is allowed in and what's not, what is allowed in and out and what's not.
Yes, another name for it is really economic coercive measures, very coercive. It means economic strangulation. And as I say, it means the most basic supplies can't be sold, can't be purchased. And whether, of course, we see it over so many decades against Cuba, Venezuela, it's well known, but 40 countries, this becomes a real effort by the U.S. to control their economic dominance in the world and to threaten every country where they don't agree with the government. But against the Palestinians, it reaches a whole new level.
Did you have any kind of take in Cairo? You stayed in Cairo. You weren't able to move beyond Cairo, right?
That's right.
Did you have any kind of sense of how this situation is affecting the mood in Cairo?
Well, everywhere in the Arab world, the support for the Palestinians is overwhelming. And of course, we've seen images of the demonstrations of literally millions of people. It's also true in every Islamic country where it really is strong, deeply rooted over decades, over generations. Now, in Egypt, as I say, this is a military dictatorship. So I think there was one demonstration allowed early on for a very short period of time. And since then, not at all.
I think I've seen some footage of a large demonstration in Cairo.
Yeah, in Tahrir Square early on. I think that was the only one.
Okay. We keep hearing, and it seems more and more likely that Israel's goal is to force Gazans through the Rafah crossing, ultimately into the Sinai Desert. But there's nothing there today besides this coastal town that we were talking about, barely even any roads. Two-thirds the distance between Cairo and the Rafah crossing is just desert. So what can that possibly mean to force Gazans into the Sinai Desert? Does it mean force them into Egypt or literally force them into the Sinai Desert, which looks like a place where people couldn't live?
Sinai is absolutely desert, barren, completely undeveloped. And so this is really Israel's final complete expropriation of the Palestinian people. And once expelled, it's clear there's no returning. And it is why it's been totally rejected by every Palestinian group and by the Egyptian government, because they obviously don't want more than 2 million Palestinians in Egypt, even if it's into an endless desert encampment. Gaza itself is extremely lush, coastal, could well feed itself, could well meet the needs of the people if it weren't constantly bombed, destroyed. That this is really the problem. And an intentional problem to make every part of life unlivable and to reclaim more and more. It's part of the land theft. And the same process is going on in a different way in the West Bank today, where every single Palestinian village and town is under attack. There are settler gangs that have really become vigilante groups or like lynch mobs. They go into Palestinian towns and simply grab, kidnap everyone that they possibly can. There's thousands of Palestinians now in Israeli jails. And that was the first basis of the attack on October 7th, was to have a prisoner exchange over these thousands of Palestinian prisoners.
That was Sarah Flounders on her trip with a delegation to Egypt to push for opening the Rafah crossing to let aid into Gaza. For Pacifica, I'm Ann Garrison.
We shall overcome. We shall overcome. We shall overcome someday. We'll be right back.
That was Roger Waters' We Shall Overcome. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Akua Holt. The U.S. effort to escalate the militarization of Asia loomed behind last week's Asia-Pacific Economic Corporation Summit in San Francisco. During the summit, Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida and South Korean President Moon Suk-yeol traveled south to Palo Alto to meet with former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice of the Hoover Institution on the Stanford University campus, and students protested. Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer spoke with Stanford student Yoon Tzu, Comfort Women Justice Coalition co-founder Julie Tang, Japanese Peruvian American activist Grace Shimizu, and Veteran for Peace Vice President Michael Wan.
Yoon Tzu, why don't you talk about what's going on at Stanford and the issues that concern you and other students at Stanford about the relationship between Yoon and Kishida?
Yeah, so on November 17th, while, you know, both of these people are in San Francisco for APEC, Stanford, the Hoover Institute specifically, has invited both PM Kishida and President Yoon to speak at our school. Their conversation will be moderated by Condoleezza Rice, famously one of the architects behind the Iraq War. Students, of course, are very unhappy with this. A lot of us with personal skin in the game, right? People who come from diasporic backgrounds of either being Korean, Japanese, or Okinawan. And we are going to be there to say no and to kind of highlight the contradiction of Stanford presenting itself as this place of public good that simultaneously is propping up and basically platforming this trilateral alliance and deepening militarization that is hugely unpopular, you know, for people all over the world.
And Grace, you recently returned from Japan, and the militarization of Japan, they're expanding the bases, building a new base in Okinawa. The budget of Japan is being increased, encouraged by the United States. Are you concerned about militarization in Japan and also the effect of that in Asia?
It's really concerning. You know, what it means is about the possible destruction of the world, you know, because of the nuclear capacity of the different powers, and that all that is being brought to bear on the growing tensions in the Asia Pacific region. And that means it affects the whole region, all the people around there, as well as beyond. And so what we see in Japan, for example, is the bloating of the military budget. Recently, one of their officials said that they're going to increase the budget over the next 5 years, doubling it. It's a danger for all of us, and we have to stand up to protest it, to bring attention to it, because the APEC countries, they hide what they want to do. They say, oh, we're for prosperity, we're for democracy, we're for the engagement of all peoples and to benefit all people. But in fact, what it does is hide the realities that our people are facing. And so like in Japan, what we see, as we see in the United States, is, you know, the widening of the wealth gap, the average wage in Japan lowering, and just the rollback of the social safety net programs. And then recently, the UN even declared that Japan is now a poor country, given such indices of the lower GNP and earnings. You know, so the APEC countries are feeling that kind of economic pinch, and they are needing to do something to be able to increase their profits. And war mongering and war profiteering is one way, and the main way right now that they're headed towards.
There's a saying that if you only have a hammer, everything will look like a nail. And that's where the United States is right now. United States' strongest card right now is the military. Everything else is weaker. So what we have is the United States is trying to dominate the world. And for example, the way they've used Ukraine as a proxy against Russia is the way they're trying to use all these other countries. Israel is our proxy in the Middle East. In Asia, they're using Taiwan, Japan, South Korea. They're dragging the Philippines and Australia into it. They're dragging NATO into it. And they want to destroy China not because China is threatening the United States. What China is, it's a large economy, and they want to break them down. You might recall that back in the 80s, when Japan was doing very well economically, there was a lot of anger against Japan, and there was a book out called The Coming War with Japan, and they were talking about, we got to stop Japan's rise, even though Japan is one of our closest allies, you know, is clearly a democracy, et cetera, et cetera. So it's really about power and dominance by the U.S., and they're trying to use all the other Asian countries as proxies against China to mutually take down not only China, but all of the other Asian countries which are on the economic rise. And that's really what it's about. If you look at what's going on in Ukraine, that's what the United States is trying to manipulate all these other Asian countries into being proxies for the United States. Okay. So they're playing, it's divide and conquer. They're playing these Asian countries against China with the aim of destroying both so that the United States comes out dominant.
And Young-Soo, at the rally, there was a rally yesterday on APEC against APEC. And one of the speakers from your organization, Noda Tal, said that, that in fact, the repression in Korea by President Yoon, the attack on unions, the attack on democratic rights, on journalists. Another speaker talked about the attack on women by your president. It seems that there's a greatly dangerous situation for the people of South Korea with this, along with this militarization. Is that one of your concerns for the people of Korea, that in fact what's happening is moved towards the dictatorship and mass repression?
Yeah, I think the repression of popular struggle, it goes hand in hand with the increasing militarization we're seeing in the Asia Pacific right now, that, you know, people like Joe Biden, people like Yoon Suk-yeol, people like Kishida are pushing. You know, historically, different oppressive regimes in South Korea have been able to maintain their hold onto power, even while worsening the condition of everyday people's lives and repressing popular struggle by getting security guarantees from the United States for increased military cooperation. This is the same playbook that was used during the Park Chung-hee dictatorship. This is the same playbook that was used under Chun Doo-hwan. And I'm afraid that, like, we're seeing the same thing happening with Yoon Suk-yeol, right? The use of the national security law, which itself is a very clear remnant of the Korean War, which still has not ended. And the way this the way this presidency is using the national security law to investigate over 1,500 KCTU members, 8 of whom have been indicted and another 37 have been arrested. The fact that in May Day of this year, someone literally lit himself on fire, martyred himself by self-immolation on the steps of a court that he was supposed to appear at because of this labor repression, specifically in a suicide note calling for the release of innocent detainees. And at the same time that this is happening, the fact that Yoon Suk-yeol, Kishida, and Biden all meet together at Camp David to sign this trilateral agreement to say that we're actually going to ignore all of the problems that the actual people in our country are facing right now to deepen military ties against this boogeyman that they're posing both in China and in North Korea is absolutely ridiculous. And I think it is a primary concern also for a lot of us students here at Stanford, many of us who are of Korean descent, who see this happening, who have read the history books, and yet are seeing that same playbook used again as we speak.
And Grace, one of the issues that people have faced in the United States is this growing hysteria against China has led to a massive increase in anti-Asian hate. And as a Japanese Peruvian American, you have some experience. The history of the United States is one of incarceration of hundreds of thousands of Japanese, and that this war hysteria, this xenophobia is actually leading to attacks on Asians in the United States. Do you see this connected, the militarization of Asia, with the growing race hatred and xenophobia?
Yes, it's definitely connected. I mean, it was connected in World War II in terms of the growth of imperialism, interests in Asia Pacific, in the expansion of Japan, and then also the interest of the European powers in Asia. And then as you saw the United States getting into the World War II, you saw that on the home front here in the United States, that kind of increasing anti-Asian violence, but specifically aimed at the people of Japanese ancestry and the violation of fundamental constitutional and human rights, not only in the United States, but of peoples from Latin America who were kidnapped and brought here for incarceration, indefinite detention, and hostage exchange. And what I think we are seeing is the danger of histories repeating and spiraling out. The danger of war in Asia, what that means for us, particularly in the United States, we can expect increasing hate crimes and threats to our not only safety, but in terms of our just ability to participate in the society, whether it's at in the workplace, whether it's on the campuses in schools, whether it's in the places of worship and such. So yeah, there's a really big danger that we've already seen, and it's going to be escalating, and the war drums do not help that.
In the United States now, there are laws that prevent people from buying property if you're of Russian descent, if you're Chinese descent, North Korean. It seems that racial discrimination, national discrimination, seems to be expanding by leaps and bounds. Julie, what needs to be done about this? Because it seems that both the Democrats and Republicans are actually, by their policies, whipping up this anti-Asian hate.
Yeah, I think all the communities that are affected, and it goes even beyond the Chinese citizens, the North Korean citizens, the Russian citizens, the Iranian citizens, it goes beyond them. It really covers the perimeter of everyone, because they're all going to be affected by this housing policy. In Texas in particular, they are now passing all kinds of laws that would forbid people from those four countries, or the citizens from those four countries, from owning any kind of land. So a grandfather or grandmother who comes here to stay, to spend time, you know, watching the kids, cannot buy a house or cannot buy an apartment. An American of Korean descent who try to buy a place, and the first thing the real estate agent is going to ask is that, are you a citizen or not? Or prefer not to sell it to them because I don't want to violate the law. But actually, did you know that when it comes to foreigners owning land in the United States, only 1% of the land in the United States is owned by foreigners. I mean, are we that frightened when 1% of all the land in the United States is owned by foreigners? And you know who is the largest land of foreign land owners? It's Canada, okay? Right? And not China or North Korea or Iranian or Russians. But by picking people, classifying people, and forbidding them to own housing, which is provided and allowed by the U.S. Constitution, the due process rights, is absolutely unconstitutional.
Young Soo, the rally that you're organizing, what are the demands of the rally?
Well, we've drafted a temporary document for our points of unity. The following points are our points of unity. We condemn the commitments for trilateral military cooperation made between Joe Biden, Fumio Kishida, and Yoon Suk-yeol that escalate tensions in the Asia Pacific. That second, we condemn the dispossession of people's land that follows when Japan and the ROK, the Republic of Korea, collaborate with the U.S. expansion of military bases and other installations. Third, that we condemn the Yoon government's brutal repression of labor rights that is bolstered by security guarantees from the United States and Japan provided in exchange for increased military economic cooperation. Fourth, that we condemn the historical denialism enforced by the participants of the trilateral summit that forbids comfort women, forced laborers, and all other victims of U.S. and Japanese war crimes from seeking proper justice. Fifth, that we condemn the environmental devastation wrought by a trilateral alliance that stains our soils, waters, and planet with toxic waste. Sixth, that we condemn the gathering countries' involvement in arms trade and security cooperation with the Zionist state of Israel, which has now murdered over 10,000 Palestinians in Gaza since October 7th, 4,000 of whom have been children. And lastly, that we condemn the participation of President Yoon, Prime Minister Kishida, and other event conveners. Notably, Condoleezza Rice was also featured at APEC 2023. In the 2023 APEC Leaders Summit, which has already been met with fierce opposition by allies in the No to APEC coalition.
Those were peace activists protesting the escalating U.S. militarization of Asia during the Asia-Pacific Economic Corporation Summit in San Francisco. They spoke with Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer.
Everybody's talking about baggism, shaggism, raggism, madism, raggism, taggism.
Give Peace a Chance, performed by Louis Armstrong. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Akua Holt. Today, the situation in Haiti could not be more dire. Paramilitaries continue to terrorize the population. Over 5 million Haitians, including 2.5 million children, are experiencing food insecurity in a country of 12 million. And now, the UN has authorized an invasion force to prop up the unelected repressive government. As always, Haitians continue to persevere in the face of these daunting challenges. One shining example is the University of the Dr. Aristide Foundation, which now has over 5,000 students and has recently opened a new teaching hospital, so desperately needed in Haiti. Mrs. Mildred Aristide is the former First Lady of Haiti. She was born and raised in the Bronx. Her parents, fierce opponents of the Duvalier regime, immigrated from Haiti to the United States in the late 1950s. Mrs. Aristide is the mother of two beautiful daughters, a lawyer and organizer, an author, and the wife of President Aristide, the first democratically elected president of Haiti and the leader of the Lavalas movement. Minister of Information J.R. Valerie of Black New World Media interviewed Mrs. Aristide in Oakland, California on October 21st, 2023.
Ms. Aristide, it's an honor to have you here. I've listened to your speech. One of the things that you talked about was education. What is the relationship between decolonization, liberation, and education in Haiti's respect?
Decolonization, if, you know, some describe or define decolonization as really as a failure to see self. When a person is colonized, you don't see yourself. And what we endeavor and what we do at UNICA is to make our students see themselves as they are, dignified human beings, able to do, able to stand on their own, able to learn, able to find their way in life, to give them the means with which to find their way in life. And that is a process of decolonization, making them understand and embrace their humanity.
One of the things that you've talked about and other decolonizing leaders like Gaddafi talked about was the brain drain that developing nations deal with because their brightest brains want to go to the colonial master countries where they can make a good living. How does Haiti fight against something like that? I know that it's a concern. You brought it up in your speech a little bit. How does the colonized world, as well as Haiti, who is decolonizing itself or developing itself, how do you deal with a phenomenon like that?
You know, as I said in my talk, at an individual level, you cannot tell a person to not leave Haiti, given the extreme dangers that are presenting. But if we were able, and if we could, multiply the number of UNICAs by 12, one in each department, at least, of the country. That's how you counter, by showing and presenting an image of hope, of what is positive, despite the obstacles that are in place. It's to demonstrate the possible, and I think that that's what we do. And every year, we make it a point to publicize our graduation, for instance. It's broadcast live on all the national media, because it is important to see, yes, this can be done, and that leaving is not the only option. But again, I do not fault, I do not blame those who choose for their reasons, but I encourage, and we encourage, the masses to stay by giving them an alternative and say, this is what is possible in Haiti, and this is what you can do if we stay, and if we all stay, this is what we can do together.
Wait, on the second, after the second exile that you and your husband were forced to experience, you came back and built a university. What was your role in it, and what do you see your role in Haitian politics being, be it that you're from the Bronx and you married the Haitian freedom fighter and former president, but how do you see yourself, and can you speak to what was your role in the building of that university?
Well, you know, I'm a good soldier. You know, when we came back in 2011, he said immediately, we have to, we're going to reopen UNITA in September. And I surely thought he meant September of the following year, but he said, no, this year, 2011. And so, you know, we did what it takes. I can't even define what my job description is, because it's a little bit of everything. But basically, it's to support the work that our students are doing, our professors are doing, and to come here to the United States, because, as you said, born in the Bronx, so I can speak the language. So I have an obligation to explain to you what UNITA is, because you're faced with a bombardment of information about Haiti this, Haiti that, poorest country of the Western Hemisphere, gangs this, gang. And it's my moral obligation to explain what is going on and that there is another way. As I said, it does not have to be a sole conversation about security forces, troops, foreign troops, intervention. No, there is another dialogue that is going on in Haiti, and that needs to be reinforced. And I do what I need to do in order to support that.
Can you speak to what you guys are, what the school has been able to accomplish with helping to build the hospital, and how many of the graduates are involved and teachers? What is going on? What is the hospital project, and what's going on, and what's its relationship to the school in Haiti?
Okay, so the hospital construction began in 2019. Maxine Waters helped us break ground on the construction, and from the get-go, the construction design was by someone at UNIFA. The engineer who was in charge, a civil engineer in charge of all the construction, was a teacher at UNIFA. The agronomist who helped create the space, the green space, was UNIFA. So UNIFA was absolutely involved in all of the work. And students would come by as the construction was going forward, engineering students, to see and to explain, well, this is the mix. And I'm not an engineer, but, you know, the process was being shown to the students. And our students in health sciences will do their practical training at our hospital. We already have several of our nurses graduates who are working in the hospital. We have, as of this year, I think it's two of our graduates from the School of Administration who are working at the front admissions office. And we have graduated now since 2011, when we came back from exile and we reopened, we've graduated 1,176 students. And we're on course again this year. The academic year has started. The situation in Haiti is difficult. There are a lot of students who unfortunately have left the country, some of the teachers, but we're on course to have a successful academic year with the support that they're getting from the Bay Area, from HERF, from Haiti Action. Really, you know, it takes a village. It certainly has taken a village to create UNITA.
Two more questions. One, in October, earlier this month, the UN basically authorized an intervention, or so-called intervention, basically an invasion. But they're already there anyway. But can you speak to how is that going to affect the Haitian people? And in particular, how is that going to affect the education system?
We know what a 15-year invasion by the United States created back in the beginning of the 20th century. We know that intervention by international forces introduced cholera into Haiti, and that we lost at least 10,000 people to cholera, a disease that had never existed in Haiti, and that was because of an introduction by UN forces. We know that there have been the rape of many women and the abuse of many young boys and men as a result of this intervention. We know that. What will come about new intervention, I don't know. What I do know is what we are doing must proceed, regardless of what happens at that level.
The ransom, can you speak to, you Can you speak to the ransom that Haiti has and has been basically forced to pay France, and give a nutshell history of that?
Absolutely. As I said, we get our independence in 1805. No other country recognized our independence. In 1825, France said, "I will recognize you, Haiti, but you must pay me 150 million gold francs." And at that time, that represented 10 times Haiti's national budget. And it was on the threat of re-enslavement. We had just come out of a war of independence, and so the country was not in a position to refuse. In order to make that first payment to France, on the same boat, that same warship that bought the ordnance from the king to Haiti, two Haitian emissaries had to return to France and go to a French private bank and borrow that money. So from that point on, there was a double debt: the money that was owed to the government of France, and then the interest and repayment to the private French bank of that 150 million gold francs. There was a reduction later on, but the bulk amount had to be repaid, and only after more than 100 years was the entire amount paid, after the United States intervened and took over in as a banking institution. And so Haiti continued to pay, but this time not to a French bank, but to the U.S. bank, which is Citibank Group.
Wow. How do you and your husband look at what's going on with Niger? How do the Haitian people look at what's going on with Niger, their relationship with and fighting off French colonialism in particular in the nuclear sector? But can you speak, what are you guys seeing from Haiti in that?
Haiti is a very internationally minded people. And so Haitians are looking at solidarity movements throughout the world. And they see in the liberation movements that are afoot now in Niger and the other countries, they understand. They understand the necessity for there to be autonomy, dignity, and autonomy. And so there was complete support for all revolutionary movements. Haitians are very concerned about what's going on in Gaza, because they understand what it means to be repressed. And so Haitians are very much in solidarity with all of the movements that are in Lebanon because of our own history of incredible suffering.
How do people support the hospital and the university?
HERF, the Haitian Emergency Relief Fund, and Haiti Action right here in the Bay Area have been two of our greatest supporters. And through them, we've been able to expand our work, expand the reach of the university, and really start with the construction of the hospital and be where we're at with the hospital.
Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you.
That was Mrs. Mildred Aristide, former First Lady of Haiti, speaking to the Minister of Information, Dr. Valerie of Black New World Media. That was Boukman Experience. Gray Zone journalist Aaron Mate confronted Delaware Senator Chris Coons about U.S. support for Israel's war on Gaza last week. Pacifica's Ann Garrison has the story.
Last week, Gray Zone journalist Aaron Mate bought a ticket for an Amtrak train headed for Washington, D.C., and found himself sitting across from Delaware Senator Chris Coons. He then confronted Coons about his support for Israel's war in Gaza.
Senator, I'm sorry to put you on the spot, but when I call for a ceasefire in Gaza, I'm a journalist, my name's Aaron Mate. When I call for a ceasefire in Gaza, you have 4,600 children killed.
This is 46.
I know it's a quiet card. I apologize for abuse, but I understand. But children are dying. Children are dying, sir. More than 40. When I call for a ceasefire, they're being killed with our weapons. U.S. weapons are killing kids in Gaza.
After being removed from the train at the next stop, Mate recorded an account of what had just happened, ending with a message to the senator.
So I've just been removed from an Amtrak train going to Washington, D.C. after I questioned Democratic Senator Chris Coons about his support for the Israeli mass murder campaign in Gaza and his refusal to call for a ceasefire. After I questioned him, he left his seat, then he came back, and then he asked that I be removed. And so a Amtrak staffer came over and told me to change seats or else I'd be thrown off the train. And in Senator Coons' defense, this was the quiet car. And so I did violate the norms of the quiet car by questioning him about his stance. But I felt this was important because we're talking about a massacre in Gaza. And I felt okay violating the norms of the quiet car, given that I believe we're violating international law by supporting the murder of so many innocents inside Gaza. So after he made that request, I did move my seat. I complied and I sat somewhere else. And the train continued along. But then a while later, he walked by me. We did not exchange words. I was respecting the sanctity of the quiet car and his request that I no longer question him. But shortly after that, the train stopped in Philadelphia. And all of a sudden, I was taken off the train by police and told that I had been thrown off by the conductor. I'm assuming at the request of Senator Coons. So Senator Coons, if it makes you feel better to have me removed from a train because I bothered you, I understand it's not pleasant to be questioned, especially not to be questioned about supporting the mass murder of civilians. But what I hope you will still address is why you are supporting this mass murder, why you won't call for a ceasefire along with some of your Democratic colleagues who are in the House. And I don't regret at all questioning you about that, even though it was in the quiet car, because right now, as inconvenienced as you were by my questions, there are over 2 million people in Gaza who are being massacred and displaced. And given that this is being done with U.S. weaponry, their rights need to be addressed and these questions need to be answered.
That was Gray Zone journalist Aaron Mate addressing Delaware Senator Chris Coons after being removed from an Amtrak train where he confronted Coons. In Berkeley, for Pacifica, I'm Ann Garrison. 'Cause I know that everyone knows it's time to take Palestine back this time. We won't hesitate now. I know that this is the sound of war. What about in Utz, Ramallah, West Bank, Yaffa, Gaza? Two time for the people in Palestine strapped up, ready all black and hot. Know that everyone knows it's time to take Palestine back this time. We won't hesitate now. I know that this is the sound. 'Cause of war. I know that everyone knows it's time to take Palestine back this time. We won't hesitate now. I know that this is the sound of war.
Eddie Mack featuring Batata, The Sound of War. And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all Pacifica sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective with contributions from Steve Zeltzer, Ann Garrison, Paulina Vasilia, and myself, Akua Holt. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on X, formerly Twitter, at Pacifica CRD. I've been your host, Akua Holt. Thanks for listening.